Good afternoon, everybody. I am so excited to be doing the soft launch, a question we've just been debating, for Lisa Scatolini and her wonderful new book, Loyalty. And Lisa is the author, as you know, of a gazillion books, From Everywhere That Mary Went, which is when we first met in the women's bathroom in the Hilton Hotel in New York at the Edgars. She has written Rosato and Associates, Rosato and D'Annunzio series, lots of nonfiction with amazing titles, really funny, with her daughter, Francesca, who is an author in her own right, I might say, and also quite a lot of fiction, and recently decided that historical fiction was going to be her thing. And so she wrote one called, if I remember right, Eternal. Was that not it? World War II in Rome. Wonderful story. And now she's progressed to Sicily and the rise of the mafia. Coincidentally, Rob and I are going to Sicily in January.
Oh my God, we have to talk. I'll tell you
all. I know. I'm really excited about this.
The answer is anywhere. Like anywhere you eat, it's awesome.
That's what we're told. David Hewson. Do you remember the wonderful David Hewson, the British author?
Yes. Told me that
the best food you can have is touring Sicily. So it'll
That's
be great.
True. That's
and
true.
Joining us is our guest host, which means I'm shortly going to shut up and it'll be all Hank. Is Hank Philippi Ryan, the multi-award winning legendary TV reporter, journalist. God, how many Emmys have you won?
37.
Who's counting?
Right. I'm old though. I'm old. What can I tell you? It's old.
No, you're amazing.
No, she's really astonishing. And one of the most skillful hosts and interviewers that I have ever encountered, all while fabulously dressed and wearing spike heels, which is something I really hate her for because I can't do it anymore. But anyway, in her new book, The House Guest, is a smash. It's reprint. Oh, good. You have your
sensational, thriller.
It actually is. It really is wonderful. And we have a couple of signed copies left at the Poison Pen. And Hank has been on a relentless tour. My God, how long have you been on tour with The House Guest? Weeks.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've been on tour for several weeks. You're absolutely right. It went into a second printing after 6 days.
Woo-hoo!
You have the first editions, Barbara. You snagged them. So they're gone, except for you, I think.
Well, I'm happy that I was really crushed when Hank couldn't come out and see us, which was really at my request because the weather was so weird here in February that thank God for Zoom, because it did mean that no matter how awful the weather was, no event went down, you know, it just shrank physically and became bigger online. But anyway, I've missed Hank and I'm missing Lisa. So I really hope next year we can work this out so that we
absolutely.
Can.
Absolutely. But before you go and live your life, Barbara, I just want to say that thank you. And I want everyone to know Poison Pen is one of the most incredible independent bookstores in the entire country. Barbara supports authors starting out best-selling. And I know that because when Barbara got an advanced copy of my first novel, which was a paperback original, she called me afterwards. She read it all the way through and said, and as a female lawyer, I was so honored. And you're like, I really like this book. And I honestly cried. And I still do, actually. I'm so grateful to you for that. And I want people to understand how wonderful Poison Pen is and how important bookstores like it are across the nation. We need them, so please support them. You have to shop in them to keep them alive and happy. And we're grateful, grateful, grateful to you, Barbara, and everyone who supports Poison Pen.
No, that's so kind of you. Let me add to you that in an era of book banning rising dramatically, there is no book banning at the Poison Pen.
No.
We don't succumb to political pressure. Actually, with any luck, we don't even carry political books. And I'm proud to say, although this is going to make me really unpopular, that we've only sold 3 copies of Spare. Sorry, because I like
Spare, but that's just me.
You might like it, but well, anyway, I try to stay out of the political arena because in truth, we want people to come and have a wonderful time and escape from some of the grim realities of life by, you know, plunging into fiction. Lisa, however, in this wonderful book, does remind us that there are grim realities like the mafia, but she's taking us way back in time. So, Hank, I'm going to turn this over to you.
Thank you. It is marvelous.
Barbara.
And Barbara, yes, I agree with you, Lisa, as always. You know, it's such a safe place. at the Poison Pen, and such a life-changing, wonderful place to meet new people and meet new books and discover new worlds. And we do discover new worlds in loyalty, which I, first of all, you all, look what was in the New York Times book review this morning.
You know, I had an orgasm, let me just say. At least I think that's what it was. It's been a while, but I was like, wow, wow.
Well, the praise and the glory for this unputdownable piece of historical fiction, says Kristen Hanna. And I was trying to figure out how to describe this book because it's historical fiction. It's a love story. It's a legal thriller. It's a murder mystery, a kidnapping mystery. It's just an epic, epic novel. And I want to hear all about this, but this epic, how did you decide? How did you get your hands around the amount of passion that it needed to write, that you needed to write this book?
Oh, you're so kind. Well, I guess if I thought about it for a moment, first of all, I'm the luckiest person on the planet because I have such wonderful readers and bookstores that have supported me for 35 years and 35 novels now. And so I write domestic thrillers, I write the Rosato series, and more recently, I guess with Eternal, I've always writing about family and justice and love. And that sounds formulaic, but you know, as book people, that there is no formula. Like if there was a formula, believe me, I would copy the, I would do whatever, right? We sweat everyone, especially if you're me and you write without an outline, you're basically in a panic attack for about a year. And I guess I've just, as I've gotten a little older, I'm aging before your eyes, actually. I thought, you know, why do you start to think about whether law leads to justice and what is the purpose of law? And then you start to think, well, that what the setting and the time in which those things take place is just superficial. Like historical fiction isn't a separate genre. This is sort of a historical thriller, but it's really about the rise of, it's about four lives that collide against the backdrop of the first mafia family and the last Jew in Sicily. Because there was so much in Sicily that was going on at that time that really had so much to do with justice and crime and families. It was, everything was pinging off of everything else. And the funny thing is, I have a little prop I wanted to show you. What started the idea, I was going to show you Bradley Cooper. Do you want to see Bradley Cooper? Because I
always
did.
Always.
I did. Oh, he did.
Hi, Bradley.
This is the soft opening. No, sorry. Okay.
You're out of control, Scottaline. You are totally out of control. Hold up the book. Tell us where the idea
is. This is the little book. I was just reading all about Sicily and about the mafia because I love mob stuff. I love The Godfather, but it's weird when you're Italian American, as I am. You can tell by my nose. My mother always says we get more oxygen than anyone else, and we do. That there is a stigma about Italian Americans because of the mob. So it's a little hypocritical to love mob books and mob movies, but also be Italian and then bitch about it, frankly. But I started to do research about Sicily. I want to understand what gave rise to the mafia. Now that's not a story, that's nonfiction, but I made it into a story because I have a guy who's like super handsome, kind of like Bradley Cooper, only darker, and can ride a horse. Wow. And so what happened was I came across this little book. I saw it online and then I bought it. It's a rare book. It is the guide of the real madhouse, the Royal Madhouse of Palermo. And it really existed in Palermo. And I was like, what's that about? And it turns out that the man who ran it, who was a baron, basically did something in the 1800s, which was worldwide remarkable. He decided that people who were mentally ill, then called lunatics, shouldn't be treated like animals, shouldn't be treated and locked away in cells, because by law, you enabled to treat them that way. He said that he was the founder of moral therapy. And I thought, that's so interesting. And that's happening sort of a very enlightened stand as against the rise of the mafia, which actually begins in the lemon groves of Sicily. And we can talk about why that happens. Excuse me, Bradley's coming in my way. So I broke him in half. I have that effect on men. Like they don't last. It's like, but I only need the lower half.
Okay, anyway. So Baron Pisani makes an appearance in Loyalty. Yes. I'm keeping you on track. You see me doing it. Keeping you on track. Baron Pisani makes an appearance in Loyalty. And so that was the beginning. I mean, this is sort of like, Loyalty is sort of like the Godfather for book clubs. You know, every book club is going to absolutely delve into this novel and understand think lots of things in a way they might not before.
I hope. I mean, I think you look at the mafia because you think, okay, first question, is the mafia, is criminality inherent to Sicilians? No. But you have to look at, in a way, I was kind of setting the record straight and want to understand it myself. So that I go, what caused the crime to become organized in Sicily? Because that's where the mafia started in the 1800s. And what you noted was a change.
What does organized mean? What does organized crime mean?
That what happened was instead of just, there were people on, lemon groves were in the area of Palermo, which was irrigated by the Arabs. Previously in Sicily's time, they've been colonized many times because of the location in the middle of the Mediterranean. Only nobility can own land. It's essentially feudal. So the land is granted to you. You just can't buy it like you can buy land nowadays, right? So then what started to happen in Sicily was that the law changed. And that's what I love, that the law produced the criminality. Because the law, what started to happen is the nobility couldn't afford to maintain the land. They weren't allowed to sell it off until the law changed in about 1810. When they became able to sell it off, two things happened. They got a little money so they could pay their taxes. And people who had a little money could buy land. But Sicily was overwhelmingly illiterate, overwhelmingly poverty-stricken. The only people who could buy land were the actual managers of the lemon groves. And what they started to do was, because there was so much theft of lemons, because it was such a valuable, valuable crop, they banded together as a group of managers of lemon groves, and they organized a protection racket. First, they go, we'll protect your lemons on the way to the dock, because the British Army discovered that lemons cure scurvy. And so it's like that stuff you learn in social studies. I was like, lemons, who knew? But then what happens is that shades into, wait a minute, we want to make more money. And so the people that we can protect the lemon from is us. So we see Franco, who's the beginning character, and he wants to move up, and he can't move up until the law changes. And then when the law changes, he still can't make enough money. He begins to organize the lemon growers, and he and his brother form the first mafia family. And at the same time, I didn't make this up. It was incredible. There is, I discovered in my research, an organization called the Beati Pauli, the Blessed of St. Paul. At the same time in Palermo, because there was so much corruption among the police and all of the laws were tilted in favor of the nobility, all crime was unpunished. So that there were a group of noblemen, aristocrats, who were good-hearted aristocrats. And they would meet in secret in the basement of a church, which I visited in Palermo. All of these are on my website, videos. And they were called the Blessed Society of St. Paul, and they would try to solve crimes, just like the old Star Chamber. And so I said, well, this is great stuff, because you have a real bad guy in Franco, and you have a real good guy in Gaetano, who's, guess what? A lawyer!
He makes a big appearance, obviously, in Loyalty. You're talking about the four people whose lives come together. And what got me initially in this interview is that you so casually said you don't work with an outline. And this is such a voluptuous, huge novel, and you're juggling so many characters in such an understandable way. I mean, it is complex, but it is not complicated. It's easy to understand. It's easy to follow. We understand who each person is and why they want what they want. How much did you know about your characters when you went in, or did the story just evolve?
Well, first the answer to how you do it is that you drink heavily. I have LaCroix. This is how middle-aged women celebrate the book launch. So let me take a sip. I didn't know. I didn't know what would happen. I just sort of thought, what would logically happen next, especially when you have the first mobster, and a lawyer who's going to try to do good, and a kid who gets kidnapped, who's thrown into a mental hospital, and no one cares about him.
I just got goosebumps. I mean, tell us about the main characters of the people and how their lives, you know, how it is set up for their lives to come together.
Right. So we start with Franco, the mafia guy. Then we have the lawyer. A child is kidnapped. And the other two, so the question is, are we going to get that kid out? And we're not giving anything away. It's the first page. The other two characters are interesting because I wanted to fill them out in the beginning and fill out, you get an overall picture of Sicily because I traveled all over in the research. And I thought, to tell this truly and to steep the reader in the fragrance of the lemon blossoms and the salty spray and all the stuff you actually do feel when you're there, it's kind of crazy, except now there's cigarette smoke, but there's, you know, it's all there. I said, well, there's another aspect that interested me and has from eternal when I wrote about the Holocaust in Italy, because I'm always interested in when law perpetrates injustice. Mm-hmm. And probably the best example, well, not the best, sadly, there are so many examples, but one really horrifying example took place during the Spanish Inquisition in Sicily and the whole in Europe. Well, it came to Sicily too. During the Spanish, because this is before the novel set, Jews, there were about 40,000 Jews on the island of Sicily living very peaceably and happily, totally assimilated. There were also Muslims there. There were Christians. And Sicilians had a very strong national character that was a beautiful kind of, like, I want to say minestrone of all of these elements, right? They are. They have their own language. They have their own food. They have their own customs and folkloric ways. But when this Inquisition came to Sicily, the Jews were expelled from Sicily in their entirety, as were Muslims. And what was fascinating is that that is still true. That took place in the 1400s. And even till today, I saw an article in the New York Times 3 years ago that talked about how Palermo still could not get a minion in a temple. The kosher butchers were driven out of business. The temples were destroyed or converted to churches. All the Jews were exiled on pain of death. Some stayed and were tortured or killed. Some stayed and hid away.
And there you have
Antonio, Alfredo. I have my Italian men mixed up. He's secretly Jewish. There were Jews who did that. They were called Muranos in Spanish. It's a derogatory term.
May I speak up for a minute?
Of course.
There's a similar thing in New Mexico. They're called conversos, and mm-hmm. they are Jews who came up from Mexico, also from the Inquisition, right. and settled in New Mexico, and don't know why they observe the rituals that they do. My husband, who is Jewish, has a relative who's involved in that converso thing. But it all comes back to Spain, because Sicily was, in fact, ruled by the Spanish dynasty. And when Isabella decided in Granada that she was going to launch the Inquisition, because Granada was just like Sicily. I've spent a lot of time there. It was assimilated. It had Moors, as they call them. It had Jews. Everybody was okay. Isabella, you know, got religion in a terrible way and decided that she would, sponsor the Inquisition and brought it to Sicily because the Spanish, you know, ruled. Sicily's had a whole history of royal houses, including Napoleon, you know, because Napoleon put one of his brothers on the throne of Sicily.
Exactly. It was terrible.
So, you know, it was...
Once again, there's nothing Barbara doesn't know about. She knows about all this.
I know. I'm just here.
Sicilian history, not a problem.
It's a fascinating, you know, it's a fascinating subject. And it was repeated in India when they decided to partition India. The people who are now in Pakistan and the Hindus and the Muslims were all living together in India. Once they decided to partition it, you know, it all went sideways. That's right. What happens every time it becomes tribal.
Yes.
And this is what you've immersed yourself in, and readers, in loyalty, is this evolution in Sicily of the power and the people who don't have power and the people who want power and the people who will never have power, and how they all come together to make some sort of society with either legal justice or moral justice or ethical justice or personal justice or romantic justice or what, or, you know, all those kinds of things come together in loyalty. So we have the mobster, we have the lawyer, we have the shepherd who's a hidden Jew, and one more sort of segment of this book.
We have to have a woman, and she's stronger than she knows, but she's, you know, it was very interesting to learn about in Sicily how women were treated in the 1800s, essentially chattel. But it was even interesting to go there nowadays, because I went all over in all the little towns, and again, those videos are on my website. On a Sunday afternoon, if you go into a little town like I did in, it doesn't matter. Bottom line is, the street's all men. After church, the men are out, the women are in cooking. This is modern day. I took a video of it. I couldn't even believe it. It was like land of men. Normally that would make me happy. But I was like, this is kind of weird. So I have a woman, she's a young mother. I don't think we'll give too much away, but just to say that she has a child, the child's born with albinism. And it gave me a chance to really, I love I love the notion of folklore because I love story. And the more I learned about Sicily, and you see that there was so much illiteracy there, the highest rate in Europe, lagged way behind. So you go, well, the Sicilians can't read books at that time. What happens? Well, a population that isn't given stories to tell tells its own stories. And the stories were compiled by a guy named Giovanni Petri in books about, and you can read where the folktale was told, and you can read about the folktale. I wanted to show you this too, because there's all kinds of folklore aspects of the novel that are also religious, you know, because it's this quasi combination of religion, but also belief in good luck and things like this, which I learned about these. Look at this, this is called an ex voto. Can you see that? Mm-hmm. If you have a stomach ailment, it's a little silver thing you go and buy. You see the stomach? You say you place that at the altar of the saint. The saint will praise for you. Here's if you have an ear problem. I just saw these things. Of course, I walk in like a freak and buy every single one of them. I'm like, if you have problems at home, here's a little house. You pray, you leave it at the church. There's churches everywhere in Sicily. It's very religious. And as you see, this is actually a breast for people with breast cancer. And anytime you go to a church, you'll see these there. This is even modern times.
I mean, it's so touching and haunting. Yes. And understandable, because it makes you feel like you have a little bit of control and a little bit of power, and that someone somewhere, something is listening to you. But right. It's again about power. It's about power.
And it's also about, for me, what I think I saw and what I read, because I read a lot of period fiction when I'm writing in the period, is endurance through hardship. That given the layers of society, the peasants were completely exploited. And this BS about the mafia was on their side is completely wrong. The mafia exploited them too. So they were exploited by the bad guys and by the nobles and by the law and by every which way of Sunday. You go, what gets you through hardship? Where you're starving. Like, you're starving. Children die of this. Children die of all kinds of diseases. What got them through was faith and religion and folkloric beliefs and the stories they told each other. And a lot of the stories have to do with endurance through hardship. And so they become impossibly hardworking people, getting almost nowhere, you know, working for kind of slave wages just to feed a family. And you realize that, you know, how lucky we are to have laws in theory that, and certainly in truth, that protect from this kind of thing. And that's the evolution of society, that the more you have laws that are enforced, you have the ability of everyone to pursue happiness. And I was like, this is so, it just moved me, man. It just, I was like, okay, Lisa, let's see if you can go there.
No, it really comes through. That passion really comes through in the book, and the sort of personal revelation that you must have felt in writing this, because you really transfer that to the reader. I mean, tears come to your eyes at the end and throughout as you see these people endure things that you help us understand. And loyalty, of course, is such an important part of what this novel, but it's also, was loyalty always the title?
No. At one point, the title was sacred, because I was thinking about what are the things you hold sacred? You know, I still feel so lucky, as I say, with your support and reader support, that I can try to write something different. And I think it's actually the same. I think it's just a superficial change of setting and location. But these themes are similar, and the book moves fast, even though it's historical. And so I started to think about what are the things you hold sacred? And sacred for me was kind of the thing I was thinking about. What do you value? But you know, it's a mechanical thing, but I didn't think the word looked good. It just,
no, I but I mean,
it doesn't look good. Like, what is that word?
But loyalty is sort of bigger. Loyalty to family, loyalty to law, loyalty to each other, loyalty that you don't really have, but that someone makes you have, you know,
right.
You know, that this is a choice. When you came, when you decided on loyalty, did just like the sky open up and heaven applauded?
Yes, exactly. It was like, angels sang. Yes. Because it's also, listen, it's not, you know, loyalty 101 where we're loyal and that's good. Sit and come. You really want to look at loyalty. There's so many levels of loyalty in this book. The most obvious one being the mafia, where they're loyal to each other and to nothing else. And how deleterious that can be. You know, that if you have no moral compass but loyalty, bad things are going to happen. And then you have a man like Gaetano, who's the lawyer and who's very, he's extremely religious. He is an admirer of St. Paul. He wants to live in the way of St. Paul. So he feels a loyalty and a kinship to St. Paul. They all are loyal to different concepts. And what I kind of love is what reality is, which is we all think we're loyal to something good. Oh, as the great Sandra Brown says, you know, the villain is the hero of his own story. That's what you want to get to. Yeah, Franco thinks he's doing the right thing.
Right. Well, loyalty is a much more human word than sacred. I think, you know, it brings us down to that level. One of the things I think is so interesting about this book is many people's vision of Sicily is really the Greek ruins, because Sicily was in fact colonized by the Greeks. That's where they sent, I can't remember, Aristotle, somebody, anyway, Alexander the Great under his tutor, whatever, it all happened in Sicily. I've been there several times, but the only thing they show you when you go are the Greek ruins and, you know, several places around the island. Yeah. It's ironic that the Greeks, who were, you know, incredibly secular and, you know, really the basis of much of our law and democracy and so forth, they've been completely eclipsed, you know, by the Catholic Church, which is responding. I mean, I haven't read The Leopard in forever. Oh, it, so did great. You see the movie?
I saw the movie.
You know, it's like one of those epic movies with Claudia Cardinale and her prime.
Yeah, she's gorgeous. But it was kind of great.
No, it was 19th century Sicily, if I recall.
Oh, it doesn't get better in terms of research, because it was written by the Prince of Lampedusa, about a Prince of Lampedusa. And he'll describe, you know, when you tour these grand houses or you see it in the movie or you read it in the book, you know, every detail. And look, I love house porn, like you're in my family room. Those are, by the way, practically all of them are from Poison Pen, I'll have you know. Because that middle panel, this is all just signed. That's signed fiction. My other rooms have nonfiction, unsigned. In fact, they even have a little gold thing, like a little dork. I have, it says signed, because I'm so proud of myself. I forget the question. What was the question, Barbara? Just got so excited.
Well, Barbara was talking about Sicily and the Leopard, and you list The Leopard as one of the books that you have read, one of the many, many books that you read doing research for this. Let me rewind for 1 second to loyalty, because loyalty is also family. And that is, you know, found family, created families, biological families, hoped for families. The idea of family and the search for that is so powerful in loyalty. And there's nothing more, you know, reliable than loyalty to your family. But what is your family? You explored that so beautifully in this book.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think a little every one of the four characters who begin separately but come together in a way that we can't reveal. You know, I think instantly of the woman, right? She, Mafalda, she's just had this child. Disaster strikes, I won't tell you, but the child has albinism, as I mentioned. She's thrown out. Like, there's no loyalty on her husband's part. There's no loyalty on her mother-in-law's part. And I thought, well, I was a single mom. I was a single mom when my daughter was aged 3 months. I was like, I know that feeling that you're completely on your own. Obviously her, you know, test was much harder than mine. She can't eat. But actually, I was pretty broke for about 5 years. So you just channel that struggle that every woman has from time to time, and every man will have enduring hard times. And you go, well, what happens? What are you loyal to when no one is loyal to you? Well, a child. You know, that child means everything to her, even though it caused her to be ousted from her entire life. Because in this folkloric tradition, if you had a child with a difference, that is completely unexplained. Albinism didn't even have a name in the 1800s. And it certainly wasn't at Sicily, which, except for Baron Pisani with his moral therapy, was, you know, was behind science as well. So what do you do when there is no one who's loyal to you? You have to rely on yourself. I think I always end up writing books that make me feel good, make me feel that I can do it. They're always little parables on, Lisa, you may be short, but, you know, because I think a lot of women are, you know, we all have hardship and we all got to get through it somehow. And it can be lethal danger, like it is in Loyalty or in, like, in all the thrillers I've written or in a lot of the books that are behind Barbara and that sell so wonderfully in Poison Pen. But we're always looking at the gravity of that offense of murder, the gravity of that kind of injustice, and how do you overcome injustice and live and find happiness? How will the kid get out of the madhouse, and how?
And how you handle it in loyalty, and I'm just going to hold it up because I'm going to hold it up a million times because the cover is absolutely gorgeous. You handle it so beautifully because on the most personal of level, the little boy has to handle his life, and society has to handle society's life. So on the most personal and on the most philosophical level, you juggle these two ways of writing. This is such a hard question, but is that conscious for you, or is it because you're such a storyteller that the themes are woven in automatically with the personal?
Thank you for your high praise, but I don't think it's really rocket science. I really think that I thought about that little boy because I learned the hard fact that kidnappings were in a lawless society, kidnappings are common. And we know that right now all around the globe, right? That happens. Well, in Palermo, because nobody enforced any laws, what was happening was people were kidnapping kids for the ransom. Sometimes the kids got returned, some they didn't. What's fascinating about it is it wasn't like 1 week later, it was like several years later. And it was the stuff you read about where the mafia would cut off an ear or a finger or whatever. And the people whose child was stolen would never go to the police about it because the police wouldn't do anything. And they feared the child would be murdered. So there was essentially, the nobility was preyed upon. At the same time, they paid for the mafia to have its jobs. So I thought, let's just be that little boy and no one's going to come for him. And believe me, I'm not going to give anything away, but nobody comes right away. What does that do to your life? You end up seeing the effect of justice. Actually, I think every character will show you what happens when injustice occurs, especially when it's perpetrated by law, because that is the most onerous and awful, right? Governmental deprivation. Injustice under color of law, you're helpless against. Yeah. You have to get out of that somehow, and you have to figure it out. And ultimately Cicely does it, ultimately these characters do, because the law is not their savior, they're their own savior.
Yeah, it's so fascinating throughout loyalty. As a lawyer you were discovering the mafia, as you were saying earlier on, the origin of the mafia. What did you learn that you didn't know before that you can put in this book that you can tell us about? How did it change your feeling about what happened and the result?
You know, I think what I learned is that what I started to say in the beginning, that the first mafia family, which occurred right at the time of this book, so I was actually right on the law and everything like that, was actually perpetrated by injustice. It's not to get real English majory on you, but why not? I think of Merchant of Venice. There's the idea that when a society is unjust and it runs through Merchant of Venice, there's Shylock, right? Venetian society was unjust. Jews were discriminated against. And so what happens when you have that, when you oppress people lawfully, is that over time you leave them no way to go up and they get angry. You know, Shylock says in Merchant of Venice, you spit on my Jewish gabardine when I see you on the Rialto. You are able to discriminate against me, and that's wrong. And it makes him angry. So some people go, Shylock's terrible. But actually, Shylock's a victim. So the mafia starts because they can't buy the land. They have no, even though it becomes free, they have no hope of buying the money. And anybody who is, look, when I started to write, I was in terrible credit card debt, just trying to live and support my kid. You know, when those credit bills come in, you don't even have a hope of paying off the interest, much less the principal. You're not going to get there. And it's sad and it's horrifying and it makes you feel bad. I wanted to go to what poverty feels like, because poverty is not ennobling, it's actually embittering. And I think that's what happened to the mafia. So they go, God, we're gonna fight our way into this, we're gonna organize and you're gonna pay. There's a class rivalry that happens. And so I didn't realize that, but it made me, I don't wanna say, oh, poor mob, you know, it was amazing when I went back there, you know, I went to the prison where they all are nowadays. And you see they threw me off. I almost got arrested. They wouldn't let me film there. I'm like, guys, this is a prison. This is public property. Meanwhile, my pocket had just been picked, so I didn't even have a passport or a wallet. I didn't even have an author photo, which we all know looks nothing like me. So I was like, they always arrested me and I couldn't prove who I was. Things were going really well. But
go ahead, because I want to ask about that trip, but go ahead.
I forget. Well,
you were talking about the mafia. You were talking about what you learned about the mafia. And poverty and the embitterment of poverty, and what that gives rise to, you know, is the retaking of power or the reorganizing.
Exactly, force. Inequality will cause criminality. And that, and so to a certain extent, people who become criminals were victims.
You all who are listening, Lisa and Barbara and I can't see your comments and we can't react to what you're saying, but I know you must be wildly applauding this wonderful book, Loyalty, and I will get to your questions in just a couple of minutes. I want to point you all to Lisa Scottolini's website, which is full of incredible videos of Lisa on tour with her camera, showing us the very places that are in this book. Please tell us about this magical mystery tour of yours to Italy and what that was like. And you got your pocket pick and your passport taken.
Such a genius. I actually loved doing it. It's the only time I've been out in the pandemic. There was a window between the COVID things.
Yeah,
and
I was like, variants.
Okay. Variants, right. And so people, this is why she has all those Emmys, right? Because she knows these words.
I know words. It's good.
And so basically, I thought to myself, I guess also I love what I do. And I love it, whether it's domestic thriller or it's historical thriller, whatever it is. So I was like, I'm learning all this stuff. I'm filming it. I do it for my own research. But I was like, why don't you take them there? Because nobody's traveling right now. And not everybody has the money to get to Sicily anyway. So I started to film it. And then I started doing that with The Eternal in Rome. And then I love it, especially for the historicals. What I love about us now on this technology right here is that I do it too. If I like see something on TV or read something in a book, I'll instantly look on my phone. Oh, when did that happen? I kind of am always like supplementing my reading. And I said, well, you can do that. And so basically what I did is, I think it was every Monday night from November 7th, I went online on Facebook and I told them about the photos, or I told them about the book that I, or every little bit of research that was interesting, because you know, part of it is, can't get in the book. You'll bore people to tears. And I'm supposed to write fast-paced books. Like, that's my job. But I knew that people are intellectually curious. Is what I love about readers. They're lifelong learners. So I want to tell them this. There's even an interactive map on my website where you can, what we did was take pictures that I took on the website, put them on this map. You click on like Lemon Grows of Palermo. You see actual videos I took and actual films I took. And you learn a little bit. And it's fun for book clubs, but it's also fun. I never want to leave anybody behind. We have a whole series of virtual events like this one being my fave. And also we'll be doing a virtual book club for anybody in book clubs, and also an a cappella book club, maybe because I'm a single lady, that I always feel like you're a little left out. I don't want anyone left out. So
look, what's an a cappella book club, meaning without accompaniment?
Without accompaniment. Here I am. I am without accompaniment, because a lot of people write to me and go, I'm not in a book club and I'm sad. And I go, don't be sad, honey. You're in my book club. And now you come to a virtual event and I won't leave you out. Nobody gets left out. That's what's so great about books to me. You know, like when you were saying that being a tribal or whatever or political, books are open-hearted.
Yeah.
Books are open-armed. People who love books are generally like that. Honestly, I think we have a lot of empathy because we read so much. Oh, what's it like? You know? And writers with good imaginations can reproduce an experience. Hank in The House Guest. Hank, who's been married faithfully and for how many years, Hank? You just had an anniversary.
27.
Okay, okay. She wrote about a divorce and it was very credible. I'm divorced twice. I'm like, this girl just nailed post-divorce.
Well, I've been divorced.
Well, not in a long time, girl. Not in a long time. And I think, you know, you're trying to go within yourself to really mine your emotional truths and make them real for readers. And
yes,
right.
I completely agree with you. And I think that when people say, well, is it based on real life? You're like, yes and no. It's based on my heart. It's based on my experience. It's based on my emotion. It's based on my imagination. But just, I want to take us back to Sicily one more time. When your videos, one of the things that comes through in your videos is your absolute awe and delight in discovering the places that you take us to. Your voice comes through so beautifully in those videos. I mean, it feels so spontaneous. How did it change your thought process to actually see those row houses and see the bakery and see the lemon trees and eat all that food. I'm, my golly, Lisa, the food in the book.
I'm like poor man Stanley Tucci. I'm like, watch me eat a prickly pear. You know what? Honestly, I don't know. I just feel like I'm so lucky and I don't get out much. Like I'm in the crate and it was basically, I'm a dog in a crate most of the time. And COVID has only made it more so. Yeah. And I was just delighted. You know, as anybody who travels, you're like, look at this. This, you know, it's still a place you can go where the food's different and the air does smell different. And I'm from Philly. I've never been in a lemon grove. Barbara has a lemon tree in her backyard. I was so excited when I saw it a few years ago. She gave me lemons, which I took on the rest of the tour with me. That's, you know,
right. You can't beat the smell either. I'm telling you, the windows open, the orange blossoms, there are orange trees right outside our windows. And the lemon tree, Rob put in a grapefruit tree, but it doesn't smell. But, you know, it's hard to explain just the incredible delight of the blossoms in that scent. And so much of the world, it seems to me we've lost a lot of that, especially in relation to food. I mean, you can go to Costco and buy kiwis, you know, from New Zealand in the middle of whatever. And I love it when it's, you know, again, regional and seasonal, and you can remember the joy of, you know, food coming in and, you know, tasting your like first apple of the season.
But in Italy, it tastes different in Italy, doesn't it? Like a peach is more peachy and wine is more different. Winey.
Well, it's not agribusiness. I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, the last decent tomato I ate was in Turkey. Yeah. I mean, you can't get a decent tomato.
Only Barbara Peters could say.
You know, it absolutely is true. Once you've got agribusiness and, you know, farming on a massive scale and so forth, you lose that astonishing local. I have one question I want to ask Lisa, which seems really basic. Translate mafia. What does it mean in Italian?
Mafia means, I learned it. It means feeling bold and brave and sexy and attracting attention. To be mafia was considered a good thing because it was like, ballsy. And so your outfit could be very mafia. And that's why they got that name, because
it's actually an adjective.
It's actually an adjective and it's actually not a pejorative.
But it's become a noun. And I think that's so interesting.
What a great question that is.
I tried to get that vibe because when they ride through the town, you know, there's something about a man on horseback first. Let's get real. I mean, right. So it's like they have you can imagine what they're wearing. Right. And I look at pictures of the time and there's leather belts and they have the bandolera like this and they're sexy and they're unbelievably able. They're crazy toxic, but you know, in short doses, it's like the ultimate bad boy until they get really bad.
And it's interesting because you handle, when you're talking about mafia, and I was thinking as I was reading this, what Barbara's great question about what mafia means. You're a person who speaks English, writing in English about something that takes place in Italy where the people are not speaking English and there is Italian. And you so carefully weave Italian words into the book and explain them, not pedantically, but just seamlessly. So it's almost as if you're teaching us Italian along the way. How did
you? It's so nice to say that, because I have to tell you, that is a pure author's insight, and it is an insight, and maybe nobody cares but me saying this, but you sit there for a million times, you look at that sentence where you're going to define mafia and go, how can you define mafia and drop this in and without slowing the action? Or look, here's Lisa who learned a fun fact, you know, you can't like do that, especially in thrillers, because we love thrillers, we want things to happen, there's violence in this, there's gunplay, there's, you know, there's mafia wars, I mean. But you want to use the real word, but you also don't want to leave people behind, because you don't want them to go to their phone and go, what does this mean? What is this word? And I'm big on using it. I want to use it because I have a secret belief that if you litter the locutions have to be right to the time. There can't be contractions, the way people talk, the diction, even the choice of words has to be time specific. But you can't take anybody out of the story, especially Alfredo, because his story is almost fabulistic. It's almost folkloric. He's a shepherd. His daughters are his goats. And then calamity happens to him. He's the last Jew in Sicily. He's got to figure out how he can survive. He doesn't know if there's any other Jews. In fact, there aren't. Or if they are, they're in hiding. And you imagine the terror of that and the injustice of that religious persecution and what it is like to be him and live in a cave. and not be able to worship God in the way you want. And you see, so you want people to feel him, but at the same time, you want to tell it in a way that is unique to Sicily, because I think Barbara's point is so well taken. Sicily really is unique. I thought it was going to be a lot more like Italy. It's a great quote by Goethe in the beginning where he says, if you've been to Italy without being Sicily, you haven't really seen the whole thing, because Sicily is the key to everything.
And why is that?
It's that, long story short, Sicily was colonized so many times.
Right.
That it really does partake of every ethnicity and religion and race that colonized it. So when you walk around, you see all kinds of races and all kinds of colors, right? Gaetano's best friend is black. It's not a thing. He's Arab. There's Arab descent. They get windstorms, the Sirocco, from North Africa. It coats it for days when we were there. In fact, Etna, that's another story. But in any event, you know, you realize that it's really the crossroads of the world. And not to get too crazy, but it ends up standing in for the world writ large. Because how much colonization is there? And what is the effect of being colonized? And what happens to law when peoples are colonized? And what happens to the people who are colonized? You know, what about that? You know, I didn't go into it looking for that. That's just cool and interesting stuff. But it was there if you were looking.
But you were looking, and that's the thing. There's no one as passionate about writing a story and telling a story and unearthing a story and providing a story as you are. And it sounds like that your research and your trip blossomed your story into something that you never could have imagined that it would do.
Doesn't that happen with you, Hank, that you get energized by something and it speaks to you and you go, well, tell me.
No, I agree. There's a moment in writing every book, one can only hope, pray to all the muses, that you think, oh, that's what this is about.
And exactly.
And it means so much more than I thought it meant when I went in and typed chapter one. And you sort of, you're in search of the story, you're in search of the theme, you're in search of the... I read an interview with David McCullough once, and he was asked, Mr. McCullough, is there a... do you have a theme for every book that you write? And he said, yes, I do. And I write the book to find out what it is.
See, that's really true. That's really true.
Yeah. And so when you finished your book, I'm not talking about the first draft, but I'm talking about here you hit send and there is loyalty and there it is and it's in production. What did you think?
Well, my heart's always in my throat. Because I think a little bit, for example, when you write Rosado in the Rosado series that I've written, I love doing that series and I love looking at those women over time. And there's a really good story each time and a really good thriller, but this is much riskier than that.
Yeah.
Switching to historical fiction when you've written thrillers, and I, believe me, don't think too highly of me. I look online every time on Goodreads. I read my reviews on Goodreads 3 times a day. Like I check the scale, I check my ratings, I check what people say. And especially from Eternal, I mean, it was a huge risk.
Yes.
It was. I changed.
Because people would say, stay in your lane, Lisa.
I want to read a thriller. Give me some law, dudes, run around, chase cars. And I love doing that. I'm going to do it every other book. I'm going to do it all. I have nothing else going on in my life. I'm the luckiest person ever. But so when I sent Loyalty off, as with Eternal, it was risky. And a lot of the reviews, which makes me so happy, say, they're my readers, right? They go, I don't read historical fiction, but I like her, so I'll give it a chance. And you're like, thank you. You're like so happy. You like want to start hugging and kissing people, which I always want to hug and kiss people anyway. But it's like, that's a gift, man. That is just a straight up gift, because that's how I am. I read widely in all different genres. I read thrillers, I read dark thrillers, I read psychological thrillers, I read, you know, all kinds of things. I read nonfiction.
It's a story, it's about a good story. It's about when someone says once upon a time, and the walls fall away.
I'm gonna send you both an article that Jackie Winspear sent to me the other day that she wrote about not being labeled. About not, you know, forget about genre and just talk about, she's saying, you know, the pressure is cross genre because, you know, that way, I mean, you know, as you know, we don't have classes at the Poison Pen. We have a file called fiction in which we put everything because, you know, it's ridiculous. It's really accelerated all of this labeling thing thanks to Amazon, because they put tags on the books, you know, so that people can find them. It didn't used to be like this. It really didn't.
I think it's so, I think also what's happening is all kinds of, if you look across the spectrum, so many boundaries are breaking down, right?
All the time.
People work from home. People do different things. People are watching television on different platforms. I think people are watching different things because of the way it's, the choice is immense. And it's kind of great. I love the time we're living in. I love it.
It makes you, but you, Lisa, I mean, I want to read you all. And I know that Lisa has seen this as we showed you earlier, but there's a quote from Daniel Silva, not only calling loyalty a gripping up all night novel of power and vengeance. I mean, you can't go, I think, Barbara, you have signed copies that people can easily click and get and should be doing that right now. But Daniel Silva says her versatility as a writer knows no bounds. And that's something you had to bravely discover.
And it's such a perfect example of how wonderful people who love books are to each other. Because I don't know Daniel Silva. All his signed collection is down there, and if you can see on the last shelf. And they're all from her. And I love Gabriel Allon. I mean,
he just took a risk too, guys. Come on. He took Gabriel out of the spy game and put him back into the art world in his last book, you know.
He's doing his painting, he's restoring,
that's what Lisa's saying. That's what the character would really do, because he's writing a real person.
Right. So I just wrote to Daniel and said, you know, I'm a huge fan of yours, and I don't know if you have the time to read this. And that's what I did with every one of those wonderful blurbs. And our communities, Hank, and I know you'll agree with me, are built by people like Barbara. Because it's in the bookstores and in conferences that she would go to in the old days, right? And probably still do, that built a crime fiction community that was a real home and enables us to do a springboard. So I'm lucky enough to be able to, you know, write the things I want to write, including historical thrillers, and come home. And
what's changed things, honey? It's really changed things, is that authors didn't have a role back then in promoting their books much. And now, you know, really the thrust of promotion really comes from authors. It doesn't come from publishers.
You know what? I'm fine with that. Because
I am too. But I'm just saying that it's giving you guys a voice that you didn't really have before. Right. All this technology, you know, social media has many downsides in my view, but it also has some serious upsides.
Oh my God, I'm so happy. And I see other authors do it too. And I think every author should get on and just talk about their book and where they got the ideas. And here's the setting and here's what inspired it. And because for me, I think it breaks down that wall between author and reader, which should be broken down. Because let me tell you something, I'm writing from the heart, no matter where the story's set or whatever.
Well, the book doesn't exist without the reader, right? The book doesn't
exist
until the movie in the mind starts playing.
That's right.
This world that you have brought them.
And every reader is going to read your book differently. That's the other thing I find so fascinating in listening to readers talk in the store. I've had readers take books away from other readers and say, no, you don't want to read that one, take this, whatever. But it's really true that every book has three iterations. It's the one that you set out to write. It's the perfect book. It's the platonic book in your head. Then there's the actual book that you do write, which isn't necessarily that book that was in your head. But then every reader, it's their own book, because every reader brings different things to it. And you know, that's what's so fascinating about it. So it's an experience, but I like the way that it used to be that readers had to go through a filter like me, but now they don't. They can just go directly to you.
Or they can go through you as well.
That's part of it, you know.
The fact that I can read the reviews. I mean, I can get out on tour, but I read the reviews and underneath it says, you know, was this helpful to you? I go, click, you're darn tuned it was. You know,
very, very helpful.
We should bring Ian back up.
Let me ask you one final question. Okay. We have a lot of questions from all the readers who are in the comments who we can't see. This is very mysterious to me, but I know it's marvelous. The readers, though, Lisa, when they close this book, and I know they'll have tears in their eyes, I certainly did. What do you want them? What do you hope? What are some of the things you hope they feel or think about when they close the final page after they read the wonderful afterword, which is valuable.
Oh, thank you. Honestly, love. I mean, I cry like a baby at the end. If it doesn't make me cry, it's not gonna make anybody. And I just felt like it ends on this note. You're always trying to towards the end. You don't know how it's gonna end. And that's like, oh, this is kind of working out. Maybe this will work out. And you feel that the characters have been through hell and come out. Mm. And I felt that with what happened to the Bennetts. You know, whatever that arc of that plot is. Hey, people who love mysteries and thrillers aren't looking for low stakes. It's not, I went shopping today. It's somebody died and the bad, you know, that's what I love about what we write. I want to go friggin' move me for God's sake. And we need to be moved by it. So this is like four stories that come together and the stakes are really high. And the people come out of decades long travail and end up better than they would have. For me, I always think, are they better than if this horror hadn't started? And the answer is they kind of are. So that you feel it's great for me, wrench of sadness at the same time you feel hope. And it's like this bittersweetness. And for some reason I have no estrogen left, but I wept at the ending of my own book, which shows I might like just need to get in control a little more, but why?
Why? We're talking about Loyalty by the fabulous genius that is Lisa Scottoline. It is out. Available at Poison Pen right now. It comes out Tuesday, right? Are we celebrating?
Yeah, it comes out on Tuesday, and Lisa signed our copies. And they should be with us out right around
Tuesday. You got the best handwriting. I tried to write really neatly because it was you. Because, you know, my handwriting is so bad
Thank
now.
You. Then we won't have people saying, you know, you've, I mean, she, yeah, it's just going to go there. Right. So you know, come back on. And Hank, I'm going to do this. From now on, when you host anything, I'm going to make you the host. I'm going to send you, and then you can field social media as you like. But meantime, we have Ian, who probably is somewhat overwhelmed by all this. So Ian, what do you have to say?
Thank you, honey.
You have had a plethora of wonderful comments coming through on Facebook and YouTube for
both.
Lots of hearts.
I'm a sucker for hearts and kisses.
Yeah, so you're going to enjoy going through those when we're through. But yes, I do have a few questions from some of
our
viewers. Do you have to read Eternal before you read Loyalty?
No, they're not related. Next question.
Next question.
I had an answer for once. An answer that wasn't 5 minutes long.
Can you comment on how different the writing experience was between Eternal and Loyalty for you?
The writing experience was so different because Eternal was told in point of view for three people, but the stories were related. So they were basically in the same place and time. Loyalty was, let's see if you can do this. Because it was a little bit, when I went to Sicily, I said, well, Palermo is so unique. A fishing village like Porticello, which is outside of Palermo, is so unique and also so Sicilian. And then central Sicily is so unique and mountainous and dry, that if you're really going to tell the story of Sicily, which is what I think you're going for, and you have to have somebody from all these different regions, that instantly tells you that these stories are, there's going to be four stories from four different areas and four different people, and that was a harder task. And also, since it was 1800s, I had to be even more careful with the language. So I read a lot of period fiction, like I practically memorized The Leopard, because I wanted to flow easily. I don't want it to feel like, what is this old timey stuff I'm reading? But at the same token, you can't have characters say, yeah, right, you know, because that's completely anachronistic and you look like a jerk.
Right. I once edited a medieval mystery in which somebody was railroaded. I still remember that.
Right.
You really do have. Yeah. I was like, okay.
Okay, slow down.
Carry on, Ian.
When was the last time you went to Italy for research?
I think I did this last October. I researched Loyalty last October, and then I left a week later and Aetna exploded after I toured it, which was great. But that was important because also that side of the island is the opposite side from Palermo, and that's where pistachios are grown, and Franco is a pistachio grower. So that was my excuse for eating really fresh pistachios off a tree, which are like, Like, apropos what you said, Barbara, I don't know if the food is really better there or you have, I have a wild imagination. Cause I'm like, you know, like sometimes food on the beach tastes better. And they're like, this is what you eat at home. But if you eat peanut butter jelly on the beach, you're like, oh my God, this is the, so I don't know what it is. But these pistachios, they have every incarnation of pistachios. It's all in the book because it's so Sicilian. It's so much a part of Franco's life.
To that point, a viewer put a comment when you were having the food discussion earlier that they don't use pesticides in the EU as possibly a reason for why food tastes better or different over maybe. There.
Yep. And also it's not traveling if you pulled it off the tree.
Exactly. You know, it's fresh. Crazy. I mean, look, I have a crappy little garden, but this was like a garden island around Palermo. And like you say, I didn't know lemons had a perfume. It felt the air smelled perfumed. You can't make that up.
How long did you research for Loyalty before you actually started to write it?
I think I've been reading about Sicily for a while. And then when I started to think, well, I guess you're going to do this, then I went crazy. And that's the coolest thing about our job. That you get to, well, there's so many cool things about a job, but you get to read all this nonfiction about Sicily. And I mentioned some of the book, and I buy the books because I just love having them. So I have actually a whole nonfiction room that's just nonfiction research. So I would say probably 5 years.
Excellent. This question is for Hank. Is Hank holding a black wing?
I am holding a blackwing. Yes, I love blackwing. How did somebody know? I can't wait to hear who had that. Yes, I am holding a blackwing. I'm addicted to these gorgeous blackwing matte pencils. They're wonderful. And the erasers come out and then you can refill them.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That was Steinbeck's favorite pencil.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, I was like, okay, I do some stuff like that. I love office supplies. That's
my hurt. It can't hurt.
I just love who. I think girls love office supplies. Yeah. Books and office supplies and carbohydrates are all like
sister.
You can't get me out of Staples. Go ahead though. I'll be serious.
For Lisa, after all of your travels, what was your favorite little gem of a town in or around Sicily?
You know, I went to Termina, which was actually where White Lotus was filmed.
Oh.
I stayed in that hotel, which is a former convent. And that was incredible. And that was a pretty storybook town. I mean, everyone said there's really nothing to go there, but I just thought there has to be some way I can work this in. And it has, you probably have been there, Barbara. It has stayed, so much of Sicily is exactly what it looked like then. And these incredible, everything's cobblestones and everything's stones and little alleyways and they twist and they turn. And they're a little mysterious like Venice can be. You're like, am I scared or am I charmed? You're not really sure. You're always like a little of both. You're like, you want to get home and you also want to stay out. It's very weird. So Termina was really cool. And to see Etna in the background, and it was smoking a little when we were there. I have videos of this on the website as well. That was really pretty amazing. And I behave myself unlike the White Lotus.
Boy, I'll say, whoa.
Oh, God. Ladies, calm down. They need their mothers to talk to them.
Why are they banning books when kids can actually watch something like The White Lotus?
I'm telling you. Yeah, right. Yeah. Get with it, people.
Wow.
And finally, Lisa, what's up next for you?
I am writing a domestic thriller. It's called The Truth About the Devlins. I do have a little mini announcement, though, if you want to know secretly something I haven't said out loud. What Happened to the Bennets is going to be on TV.
Wow.
That is such a good book. That is, I love
it. Thank you. I'm so excited. And more than that, I cannot say, but I can say that. And I will say it here first. Yeah.
Congratulations. Wow. Perfect for
that.
Perfect, perfect, perfect.
Yeah. Streaming television is just an absolute gift to storytelling. You know, it's a gift to authors. It's a gift to readers to see it on a different platform.
Do you know who's going to be the main character, though?
No, nothing, and couldn't say anyway. Ah. But there are great people making it. And I love it just because I love the culture and I love that we
And then there's some surprises, like Matthew Cork, an author that I really love that isn't terrible, you know, all that well known. And all of a sudden he has the Night Agent on. And, you know, I've watched two of the episodes so far because, you know, I have to limit my TV viewing in order to do all the other work. And I think, you know, how wonderful that now readers will also find their way to Matthew. You know,
You know, I tweeted about that yesterday because we were watching The Night Agent and I love it, completely love it. And I love Matthew Quirk, but I said to Jonathan, I wonder if this is based on a book. And then up came the credit saying this is based on The Night Agent by Matthew Quirk. And I'm like, I love Matthew Quirk. I love The 500. This is unbelievable. I didn't know he wrote this. So yeah, it's great. And what so happened to Bennett is going to be like, incredible.
Like, he was here talking to me about horses. He didn't even for The Night Agent, you know, so that's why I wrote him when it happened and said, you know, and that's one of the things I love about Zoom, and at least the way we do it, is that these conversations stay there forever. It's basically a forever book tour. It's always there. And so I have people write and say, oh, you know, I actually did have somebody write and say, remember The Night Agent, you know, so I looked for it, you know, and found it. And, you know, there's your conversation. And I love that, you know, we now have a way to perpetuate these kinds of conversations all across the world and forever, or at least as long as they last. Rob's podcast, which he does from the soundtrack. So, excuse me, he'll be making one. He's over 216,000 downloads just of the conversations, you know, from these things. And, you know, I love the fact that we're leaving this archive behind, because, you know, I'm not here forever. And, you know, it's a legacy. You've got books and I've got podcasts and, you know, conversations. And I love that. I really do.
Especially conversation like this, which is more in depth, more thoughtful.
And you know what? The other thing is, you can do this like this more in depth if you don't have an audience.
Yeah, that's
because
right.
you're not, you know, having an audience is a different experience. There have been various authors, we've talked about it afterward, that a Zoom conversation can go into more depth. And, you know, in many ways, it feels private, even if you know there are, you know, hundreds, probably going to be thousands of people watching it. You're not performing in front of them.
Well, I'm better.
The energy is different.
I behave better on Zoom. You know how naughty I am when I get there, and I just have
it's your
much,
shoes.
It's so much
it's
fun.
Your limited. It's your shoes. I never think of Lisa except when she's sitting next to me, kicking her heels.
Well, and you always get my good bra. I save my good bra for you, Barbara, and your audience.
You do. I know.
Good girl.
Anyway, it's been a joy. Thank you very much. I'm so pleased that we got to have this soft book lunch. So for loyalty, and don't forget Hank's book, The House Guest. Hank,
which is amazing and wonderful. And
absolutely,
you will love it.
Fabulous.
Put it down.
One of the best domestic thrillers that I have read. I really
She's
love it.
She's the queen of the domestic thriller. She absolutely is.
It's really well. And
thank you,
Ian,
so,
thank
so
you for your time doing all this. Welcome. And I want to thank all the readers, or fans, or audiobook readers, or ebook readers, because that's the other great thing about Zoom, is that it does go to fans who are not necessarily reading the book, because there are other ways to experience the story. So I like that too. There's a universality about it. Anyway, enjoy the rest of your Sunday. Thank you very much.
Thank you so, so much, Ian. Thank you too.
Thank
Take
you.
Care.
Congratulations.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.